Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Rick Recking. I'm a member of the Society and also part of the program committee. I'm the presider this morning. We welcome you to Prairie. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded place. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you, no matter what your age or abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. This morning, this small congregation is going to be blessed with a really special presentation by Robin Proud, our own member. With that, I'll turn it over to Robin Proud for our opening words.
For the beauty of the earth, this spitting blue-green ball, yes. Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us.
Now's the time for our main presentation today. Prairie's been fortunate for the last 15 or 20 years to have Robin Proud as a member of our society. And she's brought to us many enjoyable Sunday mornings, usually presenting in another face or another character. But today she's going to bring us some of her own observations about science fiction. So I turn it over to Robin Proud.
Thanks, Rick. It just seems like I've been here that long. We actually came in 2002, but that's 14 years. So, but before that, we belonged to a group about this size with very similar temperament in the Twin Cities, and that was since 1979. So, when most people think about science fiction, they generally think of it as something lightweight, entertaining, enjoyed by young men living in their parents' basements. But when I thought of people at Prairie, it's mostly women. I thought of Anna Bansky, Nivina Smith, who I'm sorry is not here, and Don Hazlett, apparently another fan, and some of the rest of you. And at heart, science fiction is all about asking what if. Therefore, it gives us access to some of the biggest questions that humans have been asking since the beginning of time, such as where did we come from? Where are we going? What is the best way to live, or what does it mean to be human? As you use in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning, which is a fourth principle, these are the same questions we often ask. And a couple of years ago when teaching Sunday school, the group I had was in about fifth to seventh grade. The curriculum was called Riddle and Mystery, and each week was focused on one of those big questions. This affinity between science fiction and UUism might explain why a number of famous writers in this genre considered themselves Unitarians or humanists. So today I'll just talk a little bit about some big questions in science fiction and a couple of famous authors. So two caveats to start with. I'm not an expert on science fiction. Some of you are probably more so, and I will hope to hear from you after my remarks. But some of you know I read a lot, so I've read some science fiction. And the second thing is that I'll be considering science fiction today, but not its cousin fantasy. They're often lumped together in bookstores and lists. One definition I found was that straight literary fiction shows things that could happen. Fantasy shows things that can't happen, such as magic or dragons. Science fiction shows things that haven't happened yet, such as travel to another planet or cyborgs. However, while dragons are the province of fantasy, if an author posits that dragons are created by scientific breeding, or if they're a type of complex robot, now we're in the realm of science fiction. Although writers in the eras of the Bible and ancient Greece and Rome and other civilizations always had stories about monsters and gods, what we generally think of as science fiction arose at the time when science itself became a popular concept. An early writer who didn't know she was a pioneer was Mary Shelley, who famously penned Frankenstein when she was 21. It was a wet summer, and her companions, Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, decided everyone should write a ghost story for entertainment. Now, if you've actually read Frankenstein, you'll know that it's far from the popular vision of the movies. It employed the new scientific idea of galvanism, which was electric current, to bring the monster to life. And the monster, far from being cruel and destructive, is really an abandoned child trying to make his way in the world. Now, interesting thing about that is that Mary Shelley's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who is on our list of famous UUs, who I may talk about someday, she was a very forward-thinking feminist, but she died within a month after her daughter, Mary, was born. So, like Frankenstein's monster, that daughter was given life and then left alone in the world, and she wrote a story about that. It's not necessarily a coincidence. But there are two big questions that this novel addresses. One is, what is it to be human? And is technology a force for good or evil? That is, just because we can do a thing, should we do it? Well, we're seeing that a lot these days with a lot of issues about adapting genes, or there was an article recently about growing organs in pigs or other animals for transplant to humans. So these are the same questions that we are still asking. The two writers of the 19th century who created the genre as it's really known today were Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. Many of their ideas became reality. Submarines, warfare in the air was described by Wells, and then he lived long enough to see it used deadly practice in World War I and II. The Time Machine, a book that made Wells famous, addresses partly the question, where are we going as a human race, by looking into the future. And after the time that you may remember from the movies where there are two races, he actually does go to the very end of the solar system when the sun winks out. So this question of where are we going was on his mind. The question of where do we come from was of more interest to fiction writers before so much became known about the Big Bang and our origins, but it hasn't stopped generations of writers from famously submitting to editors over and over stories like this. So don't submit this if you want to write a science fiction story. In the story, most of humanity is wiped out by a war, plague, or other disaster. At the end, the two remaining figures turn to each other to introduce themselves, and their names are Adam and Eve. Well, early science fiction around 1900 was often very positive. It described societies where machines and biological advancements gave people freedom and equality. But after World War I and continuing after World War II, visions of the future tended to be dystopias. Two classics from the 20th century are 1984 by George Orwell, which is a vision of a completely totalitarian state, and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, where entertainment and drugs keep people distracted while those in power accomplish their ends. So you might want to discuss which of these we are most close to. And of course, both of these kinds of societies do exist today in some places. Utopias and dystopias address the question of what is the best way to live? And that relates to several of our principles. The second principle is about justice, equity, and compassion. The fifth principle is about the right of conscience and the democratic process. And the sixth principle is about the goal of world peace. So all of those are addressed when we start to create how society could be. There are many more famous dystopias than utopias. This is partly because utopias are rather boring. If everyone is happy and equal, there's no conflict or drama. Also, one person's utopia may be another person's nightmare. Anytime conformity is required, or sacrifice of a person to a group, some people will find that intolerable. And it's a reasonable question whether a utopia can exist without its dark side. Here's an example from the children's book, The Giver. There's a well-ordered society where people never have to feel pain or sorrow. It turns out they also don't feel joy, fear, or other emotions, and they don't even see colors. And they keep their society going by secretly eliminating the old and the infirm. A famous story on this subject is called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce that last word, by Ursula Le Guin. She describes a town on festival day with bright colors, music, and happy people. But then she shows us a locked room where one child is kept barely alive in misery and filth. Somehow, this child must be treated in this way in order for the rest of the society to maintain its happy existence. As the young people of the town grow up, they are taken to see this child and learn its importance. Often they are horrified, but soon they justify the status quo by various rationalizations. They manage to forget that their happiness depends on someone's misery. Yet there are always a few, young people or older, who choose to leave, not knowing what else is out there, and to walk away from Omelas. This story is as much philosophy as science fiction. It was written in 1973, and you could say it describes a world that has always existed where some benefit from the suffering of others through slavery or colonialism. In 2016, we have cheap clothing and electronics because many people, including children, work in miserable conditions to produce them. And then they're exposed to toxins while scavenging in garbage dumps to earn a minimal living. So can we walk away from modern society? Science fiction is sometimes an early indicator of social concerns. For instance, let's look at environmentalism, our seventh principle, about the interconnected web of which we are a part. In the 1950s and 60s, the scary elements of science fiction stories tended to be aliens, monsters, or robots run amok. But starting in the 1970s, there were many novels and stories depicting wastelands resulting from human activities. The Earth is overpopulated or underpopulated, or the Earth is too hot, too cold, too polluted to sustain life. Terms like the greenhouse effect and global warming were used in fiction before they were widely incorporated into the general vocabulary. Even the nonfiction Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, the one book that had the most influence on the environmental movement, it begins with a fictional evocation of a future Earth where no birds sing. This powerful image, captured in the title, grabbed the attention of society. Another area of social concern where science fiction led was in questioning gender roles. Up until the 1970s, this was a man's genre. Some women wrote in the field under men's names, such as Andre Norton and James Tiptree Jr., who were both actually women. But of all the genres, this is one where roles could be questioned. A pioneer in feminist science fiction was Ursula Le Guin. Her book, The Left Hand of Darkness, depicts a race that has both male and female characteristics, assuming an appropriate role at the time of mating. Marge Piercy wrote a book called He, She, and It that describes a future where much of the world lives in crowded cities controlled by industry, and they're barely staving off the chaos that exists outside. But there's also a communal society run by women that is egalitarian and peaceful. Another book is The Door into Ocean by Joan Slonczewski. That is about a female society that lives in harmony with its watery surroundings. When a male-dominated group attacks, these people are so dedicated to their peaceful principles that they allow their children to die rather than fight back. And in the end, they win. Margaret Atwood in The Handmaid's Tale describes the opposite, a world where religious fundamentalists have removed women's rights. At that time, when she wrote it, 1985, she said that everything she depicted in it actually existed somewhere in the world. Well, all of these science fiction novels have a lot to say about gender, society, politics, and religion. The great thing about this genre is that you can have anything as your way to organize society. This was a very broad introduction to a few themes of science fiction, and that was mostly in England and the United States. Well, in recent years, writers in Asia, Africa, and Latin America are adding their voices to this genre. So let's look at just a few practitioners of this genre. Several of the most famous science fiction writers were UUs, notably Isaac Asimov, whose story I read, and Ray Bradbury. Asimov was a prolific writer in many fields. There's something about how he wrote something in every category of the Dewey Decimal System. But he was mostly famous for his classic space and robot stories. Ironically, he was afraid of flying. He would travel by car or train. And Ray Bradbury also wrote widely. Among his works are The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451, and the short story A Sound of Thunder, which some of you may remember us having dramatized here a few years ago with our young people, where stepping on a butterfly in the past changes history. Now, it's interesting that time travel is classified as science fiction rather than fantasy, so someone must think it could be invented. And today I'll just talk about two UUs who made their name in a field that was once science fiction itself, television. Rod Serling, like many of the sci-fi pioneers, was from a Jewish family. As a child, he put on plays. He was a great talker, and I am identified with this one. Supposedly on a two-hour family car trip, the rest of the family remained silent to see how long it would take Rod to notice. He never did notice the other's silence, but talked nonstop through the whole trip. In high school, he was a debater and editor of the school newspaper. When he graduated in 1943, he immediately joined the Army and trained as a paratrooper. In the Pacific, he belonged to squads that lost half their men, and he witnessed friends being killed right next to him. The randomness of death stuck with him, along with nightmares. He said, "I turned to writing to get it off my chest." He went into broadcasting originally as an actor and writer for radio. And then he wrote TV dramas back in the time when there were live dramas. One that he wrote that some of you may be old enough to remember with, and that won awards, was Requiem for a Heavyweight. But political subjects were off limits, according to the network and the sponsors. However, when he got his own show, The Twilight Zone, which was supposedly about fantastical places and situations, he often included topics that were actually commentaries on American society, such as racism. While some episodes of The Twilight Zone were standard horror fare, like evil children who can control a town or the hitchhiker who turns out to be someone who died years ago, others had strong messages. Serling himself wrote a number of the episodes, and here are two famous examples. The monsters are due on Maple Street. In a small town, people see a strange light, and then odd things start happening, such as power going on and off. Someone says that aliens have landed and are hiding among them. People start to suspect each other, and eventually a panicked mob rampages through town, smashing buildings and shooting each other. At the end, we cut to the aliens on a hill above town, where they comment on how easy it was to stir up humans by simply turning their power on and off a few times. Taking over Earth will be a snap, as the Earthlings do it for them. In 1960, this was not long after the McCarthy era. And The Obsolete Man was written by Serling and starring Burgess Meredith. Now, this is not my favorite Twilight Zone of all time with Burgess Meredith, which is the one where he's a book lover who never has time to read. So he goes into the bank vault for his break. Meanwhile, the world is destroyed, and there he is left with all the books, but then he breaks his glasses. So, however, this is a different one that Meredith started. A lot of famous actors were in some of these early ones, Robert Redford, for instance, William Shatner. Yeah. So in this one, The Obsolete Man, Meredith again plays a book lover. So Serling himself introduced the episode, as he often did. He said, "This is a future that might be an extension of what has been in the old world, using new technology for the destruction of freedom. The setting is a stark, empty room with towering doors. And at a high desk, a chancellor declares that his character, Mr. Wordsworth, is obsolete. The state has banned all books, so there is no need for a librarian, so he will be eliminated. It has also banned religion." Now, it's interesting, Serling definitely was a humanist, but here he made his hero a spokesman for religion, or at least for freedom of belief. The librarian faces his death while reading the Bible. And at the end, the chancellor himself is declared obsolete by the next chancellor. Rod Serling's final statement is right from the UU first principle. He comes back on himself and says, Any state that fails to recognize the worth and dignity and rights of man is obsolete. The other TV writer I'll mention today is Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek. Sorry. He grew up reading science fiction and became a pilot. Like Serling, he served in World War II, and later he was working with the Los Angeles Police Department. In that capacity, he became an advisor to TV shows and ended up switching to writing. He won an award for an episode of Have Gun, Will Travel, a Western. He was asked to write a series called Riverboat, set in 1860s in Mississippi, but he refused to write it with no black characters, as he was requested to do. One of his ideas for a series was about a multi-ethnic cruise on an airship, but the networks weren't ready for that. However, when the setting was moved to the future and outer space, the cast could include black, Asian, Russian, and even a non-human character, Mr. Spock. Other writers worked on scripts, though Roddenberry was often involved. The ratings were not very good, but those who were fans were enthusiastic, initiating letter-writing campaigns to renew the series. After the third season, the show was pushed to 10 p.m. Friday night to make room for a show called Laugh-In. As you may know, Star Trek reruns were a constant hit in syndication, and anyone associated with the show was welcome at fan conventions. Roddenberry also worked on some of the upcoming movies that succeeded that. Roddenberry was raised a Southern Baptist, but as an adult, he rejected religion and called himself a humanist. He said, "How can I take seriously a God image that requires that I prostrate myself every 7 days and praise it? That sounds to me like a very insecure personality." He felt that current Earth religions would be extinct in the future, and he kept them out of his sci-fi world. And of course, he used the sci-fi universe to make points about current culture. For instance, there are messages of tolerance and inclusion, starting with a diverse cast. Supposedly, the actress Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhuru, found the role ridiculous and wanted to quit. But Martin Luther King specifically urged her to stay as a beacon of hope for black viewers, where here she was a professional woman in this drama. The episode, "Let That Be Your Last Battlefield," features a planet where some people are black on the right side and white on the left, and others are the opposite. Each group insists that his race is the preferred one and that the others are too inferior to be worth negotiating with. Mr. Spock recommends they apply logic, like Vulcans do, but these adversaries prefer to destroy their planet. So if there are Star Trek fans among you, you'll probably have many other examples to share, either from the original series or one of the several spin-offs. Now, at this point, you still may be thinking outer space and creepy morality tales just aren't my thing, so I'd like to close with a reminder of a book that almost everyone knows. This book was published first as a story in a science fiction magazine, and then it was extended into a novel. And that book is Flowers for Algernon. This is the story of Charlie, who has a low IQ and gets a chance to have an operation that will somehow increase his intelligence. That's really the only science fiction in the book. Part of the genius of the story is that it consists of diaries and writings by Charlie. He starts out with very childish sentences full of misspellings. After his surgery, he rapidly becomes smarter and finally a genius. As a result, he figures out before anyone else that the procedure isn't permanent, that he will relapse to his original state and suffer an early death. So his writings after that point reflect a diminishing of his intelligence, but not of his essentially kind nature. The other striking characteristic of this book is the question we asked earlier: is technology a force for good? As Charlie gets smarter, he realizes that his coworkers in the bakery, who he thought of as friends, were making fun of him. And once he is smarter than them, they resent him and he has to leave the job. Being smarter does not make him happier. Just in the last few months, there was a real life parallel to this story. John Elder Robison is a man who has written about growing up with Asperger's. His book is called Look Me in the Eye. Some of you may know that. One thing he lacked was awareness of the emotions of others. He got a chance to undergo brain stimulation in the part of the brain that perceives emotions. When he did this, it worked. He was overwhelmed by how much emotion is out there that he never perceived. and he was surprised by how negative much of it was. He had assumed that normal people were happy and at peace. Now he saw how much fear, worry, and anger others carried, and in fact, he ended up getting divorced because now he saw his wife's depression and could no longer live with that. And just like Charlie, he realized that some of his friends had been mocking him without his realization. So is he better off than before? So questions like these take us from the realm of science fiction to the realm of psychology and philosophy. I hope these few examples will stimulate discussion around the intersection of science fiction and UU principles, and I'd love to hear from you about books, TV shows, or movies that you feel address these big questions. Now, I thought it was charming that Asimov went as far as to have punch cards, because that was in 1951, that was already pretty advanced, and a screen. Although, later on, as these things developed, he was not opposed to the use of technology in school. It was just intriguing how, sometimes it's fun to see how people in the past thought the future would be, right? We haven't got our flying cars yet.
Thank you, Robin, very much.
In our closing words, what we call a beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot. And join us for coffee and treats.